Okay, hi everybody. It's 1 o'clock, it's Monday, and it's time for Avot History and Hashkafa. This week we're going to do something a little bit different. But before I do that, I would like to dedicate this shiur to the memory of the 45 people who died in the recent tragedy at Meron. I think that a lot of words have been said about it. I think a lot of discussion has been generated by it, and I find that even though I am a person who makes his living from words and from speaking, I find that I don't have words. The best response that I can come up with is to speak of the tragedy, which is, I think, makes words collapse, is to adopt the response that the Torah attributes to Aaron when his sons were killed, Vayidom Aharon. But at least let this shir be Yalilu Nishmatam in their memory. Okay. We are at the last Mishnah in the first parak. We started this journey last summer, last spring actually, in the beginning, in when we reached the heights of the nadir of Corona. And now as we're coming out of it, we finally finished one parak, one chapter. And we haven't even scratched the surface, but that's the nature of Torah study. It keeps on going, but we will plug on. The last Mishnah is as follows. It's number 18. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer. Rabbi Simon ben Gamliel Omer. This Shimon ben Gamliel may be the same one as in the previous Mishnah, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, the head of the Pharisees at the time of the destruction of the temple. It is equally possible that we are here discussing somebody by the same name, actually his grandson, Shimon ben Gamliel, who was the father of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the Rabbi Judah the Patriarch, or Rabbi Judah the Prince, the editor of the Mishnah, whose comments are going to be highlighted start at the beginning of the next parak. Either way, just it's not exactly clear why. Who this is. In any event, Rabban Shimon Gamliel Omer, Rabbi Simon, the son of Gamliel, says, or used to say, Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam kayam. There are three things upon which the world is established, or the world exists based on three things. And those three things are Al ha'emet, truth, Al ha'din, justice, judgment, Yalla Shalom, and peace. Shene'emar, Emet u'mishpat Shalom shiftu b'sha'reichem. You should judge in your gates. When you judge, you should judge truly, truth and justice, and also peace. We'll see. That's a sort of an that's something of an oxymoron. We're gonna have to deal with that. There are different versions of the Mishnah. One version has it that the word truth comes before judgment or law, and one version has it that actually judgment comes first. I am going to go with the assumption that the word truth comes first. It's not going to change that much. It's not going to alter that much what I'm going to have to say about this Mishnah. But things will flow a little bit better. That's number one. Number two, usually when we when I discuss these Mishnayot with you, what I do is I highlight the general trends among the commentators, and when possible, I try to put the various comments in their historical context, on the assumption that, what, especially when it comes to Pirkei Avot and other books like the Haggadah, the comments that are made by various authorities are not just a matter of what does the Mishnah mean, but also what does the what ideas, what issues did the words of the Mishnah arouse or elicit what in the Mishnah spoke to that person and why? What in his life, what in his historical context made these ideas or these implications speak to them particularly? I'm going to do something a little bit, I'm going to do something of the same, but a little bit different, on the grounds that most of the commentators talk about the questions of law and how can you both be just and also have peace and things like that, which is, you know, perfectly legitimate. I want to actually share with you what this Mishnah says to me, as a person who's lives in the lived at the end of the 20th, beginning of the 21st century. In our specific cultural context, and what those things raise, and what the words of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel raise for me as a person who's not only an academic but also a rabbi and also involved in public affairs to this degree or that. Since Pirkei Avot is by definition a book which is supposed to be eternally and perpetually relevant and contemporary, so this Mishnah in particular just says so much to me that I would like to share it with you. And you are invited always to comment in the comments here on my Facebook page, on the Tel Aviv International Synagogue Facebook page. I post this also on my YouTube channel, Instagram. It's all over the place, and you're welcome to comment in or send me a direct message or whatever if there's something that you'd like to comment on and continue the conversation. Okay. Every one of the words in this Mishnah resonates. It's incredible to consider, but every one of the words in this Mishnah is controversial today. The 3rd of May, 2021, I've lost track already, I think it's the 20th, of ER, 5781. Let's start with the first one. Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam kayam. The world exists based on three things. Now, it's interesting. The first Mishnah, or the second Mishnah, rather, in the Perek, and the Masecht in general, says, al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omed. There's another Simon, who said that the world exists for three things, or stands on three things, which is Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasadim, Torah and worship of God, whether in the temple or in the synagogue, and acts of love and kindness. Here, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says the world doesn't stand, the world exists. I would like to suggest to you that both Mishnayot are discussing two different things. The ultimate justification of the world, I think Reb Shimon HaTzadik is saying, in the Mishnah number 2, is based on the worship of God. In the same way that Rashi says that in the first chapter of Genesis, that the Torah was created for Torah, the world was created for Torah, the world was created for the worship of God, the world was created for Israel, for Jews to have a special place in the worship of God and the spreading of the word of God throughout the world. That's its raison d'être. That's the reason that the world exists, and the world is sustained by that. If it weren't for those three things, for Torah, Avodah, and love, acts of loving kindness between people, the world would just dissolve. Al shloshat v'rim ha'olam kayam, the world exists on three things. Doesn't refer to the foundation upon which the world stands physically or metaphysically, but rather the how is it that we are supposed to comport ourselves in this world, based on what assumptions? Reb Shimon HaTzadik told us a metaphysical truth, a truth which is really goes far beyond anything that we can control. And the second one, and this Mishnah talks about how we have to live our lives. I think that's the difference. So, number one, what's the first thing? Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam kayam. The world is based on exists on three things, or is able to sustain itself or comport itself on three things. Emet, truth. As I mentioned, up until recently, this should have been this mission should have been self-evidently true. But we live in a world in which truth is denied. Our entire Western civilization is in the midst of an aggressive and dangerous, in my opinion, war against truth. Not any specific truth, but the idea that there could be truth. The idea that there's absolute truth. Even if we can't attain it, but there is an absolute truth to which we have to exist, it's beyond us. The idea that there's truth which binds us, which obligates us, which requires us to adapt ourselves thereto, is absolutely, positively rejected, denied by society and by what passes as culture. Everything is relative. We talk about narratives. We never really know what happened. You can never know what happened. Nothing really happened because it all depends on how you look at it. My truth, your truth. So therefore, everybody is basically epistemological anarchy. Such a position is the absolute opposite of everything the Torah stands for. Chotamo shel Kadosh Baruch Hu emet, God's seal is truth. And therefore, at the center of our world, at the center of our belief system, is the affirmation, is the knowledge that there's a God and that he embodies truth and that that truth binds us. Now, we may not be able to understand it, but that doesn't mean it doesn't obligate us. We may not be able to apprehend all of it. We may not have to prove that some things are true. Doesn't mean they're not true. And truth is not determined, by the way, as Maimonides says, quoting Aristotle in the second part of the Guide for the Perplexed, is not determined democratically. Just because most people, my mother would, may she rest in peace, would say, she'd say, yeah, what, just because everybody's jumping out the window, are you going to do it too? Just because most people do X doesn't mean that's right. Democracy is how we have to live our lives, because otherwise there'd be anarchy. But that doesn't mean that what the mob is doing is right either. The idea that there is absolute truth is at the center of our worldview, and it's responsible for almost opposite reactions. But it's not less there. Number one, it's responsible for the fact that a Jew is called upon to be to be intellectually humble, to be modest, to realize, I believe that there's truth, I'm going to try to get there, but I'm not going to arrogate to myself the idea that I can know everything. Because if I, as more than one Jewish philosopher said, Ilu yadativ hayitiv, if I knew God totally, if I understood everything, then I'd be God. But that's not possible. So the idea that there's absolute truth to which we have to accept, even if we don't understand, even if it's difficult, is number one. But that means it's stability. There's something to aim for. There's something to sacrifice for, something to live for. Now, I mentioned before that that we can't always, certain things that we know maybe can't be quantifiable, can't be proven objectively. That doesn't mean it's less true. If a person is in love, they know they're in love. If a person feels something, they know they feel something. They can't prove it. They can't prove it to somebody else. I believe, if and it's such so similarly, there are types of knowledge, like the knowledge, like belief in God, which transcend the ability to be able to prove it. Except it doesn't mean it's less true. So truth and true, and but people are afraid of truth because truth obligates. Tradition obligates. If everything's relative, he has his truth and I have his truth, I can just do whatever I want. And that's what leads to political... That's what, first of all, it leads to fake news. And it leads to lying. And it leads to... it leads to deception. It leads to... If there's no truth, then it means that there's nothing to which you have to, against which you have to measure yourself. And therefore, it opens the... it ultimately opens the door to every kind of abuse. Now they're all good there. It's true. One of the reasons why our society is so anti-truth is because there were other substitute religions, substitute absolute truths in the 20th century, which were tremendously destructive, like Nazism and fascism and communism. Socialism. And so we say, oh, there's no truth. Well, just because somebody says something is true doesn't mean that there's no truth. It just means that's wrong. What the Jew believes is that the truth that's imbued in the world by a living God is a transcendent truth. How do you know you're right? You know in your heart that you're right. You know the 3,000 years of Jewish tradition is right. Because the continued existence of Judaism and in its traditional sense and the continued existence of the Jewish people, which defies every single historical law of which I've ever encountered, would seem to bear that out. But the Torah teaches that this truth. That's all. Finish. That there's a God who gives truth. And that means, number one, that we are obligated to live by truth, and that if we and to admit the fact that if we make a mistake, that we've made a mistake. We measure ourselves against a very strong, very firm standard, which is actually kind of comforting, because it's not just children that need structure. Human beings need structure, and that's why, the Torah was given, because the Torah is derived from God's truth, and therefore it provides a structure that the Jew needs to be able to fulfill himself as God wanted. We are ultimately subordinate to God and His truth. It's interesting, just in terms of the irony of things. Excuse me. That actually, postmodern contemporary culture, with all of its supposed flexibility and there's no truth and everybody's right, and you have to respect everything and everything that goes, is incredibly dogmatic, which would seem to me to mean that even the world even the culture which attacks traditional sense of truth is no less dogmatic and even more so than the Torah. All right, that's a cynical comment on my part. In any event, what Rav Shimon Gamliel is saying, that the awareness that there is truth, which binds us, by which we measure our actions, and that we ultimately are responsible to God, is critical for the proper functioning of the world. It's that simple. Because otherwise, there would be anarchy. And all of the other things which are supposed to happen, like being nice to each other and everything else, like Gemil Chassadim, would never happen. I mean, look what happened, yes, look at what's been going on the last few days. Okay? Why do people go to funerals and to help other to help the families of the people who were killed in Meron? Why? because they felt obligated to others, because Jewish truth, Jewish morality says you have to put out, you have to sacrifice, you have to do for another person, because your ties to other Jews obligate, and your ties to other human beings obligate. It was far more than just feeling sensitive or feeling sympathetic. There was a sense of duty. And duty is because you believe in truth. Okay. Allah imet. Now, by the way, that also means that, that, as I said, that also that the awareness that there's truth also means humility. But humility to what? So here is where belief comes in. I believe that there's truth. I believe there's a God, and I defer to him. That's what Rav Soloveitchik would always refer to as, he didn't make up the phrase, obviously, Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim, that accepting the yoke of heaven, of the kingdom of heaven, meaning that our belief is that even if we don't fully understand, that we defer to God because we realize what our limitations are. I think the root sin of our generation is arrogance. Emet. We'll come back to Emet in a minute. Vel hadin, on justice, or on the rule of law. Now, most commentaries say when you come to a judge, and the judge comes to adjudicate a case, you have to be judicious. You have to be as fair as you possibly can. We have the books. A person who is not qualified should not be a judge. They should judge by the book. Number one, that's really, I find that line of interpretation of this Mishnah problematic for reasons that because the Mishnah then says that that you should aim in your interactions with people towards peace. But if you're a judge and you say you're guilty, you're innocent, you owe him money, or you don't have to pay him money, whatever the case might be, that's only going to satisfy half of the population. The other half is not going to be happy at all. So peace is not going to come from strict judgment. And as a result, by the way, it's very interesting. Despite the fact that there's an enormous literature of civil law in civil law and criminal law and torts and claims and loans and God knows what else in halacha, and you personally certainly can mechanically apply the rules to any given case, there's always a preference given to what's called pshara, compromise, that if two litigants come before the court, you should not go according to strict law, with strict rule. One reason for being that you should never arrogate to yourself the idea that you know what the rule is, because there are so many variables in every single case. How are you going to know that what you're saying is right or what you're saying is wrong? So the tradition is mitzvah livtsoa, that there's actually a mitzvah to go for compromise between the sides. Now, compromise between the sides does not mean, usually misunderstood, this whole idea. Pshara in halachic context does not mean, we'll split the difference, right? So I say you owe me 50 bucks, and you say you owe me 25, and we'll split the difference, whatever it is, at 35, or whatever the case might be. That's not compromise. That's not the kind of compromise we're talking about. Pshara means that you take the claims and needs and viability and considerations and sensitivities of both sides. And in light of Jewish legal tradition, you work out a settlement which will go beyond that which the strict letter of the law might require, according to the needs of, and according to the claims and the feasibility of both sides. Give me the chassidim if you want. That's what compromise is. So that messes up the Mishnah. It messes up the Mishnah because emet din b'shalom. So what does din mean in this case? What is if you're supposed to aim for shalom, right? For good relations and for peace and for lack of bad feelings or whatever. So why should striving for strict judgment be a factor in this Mishnah? So I actually think that the word din here means something totally different. Not totally different. It means something else. I think what Reb Shimon Gamliel is saying as follows. There are three things upon which the world exists and which determine the way we interact with each other. One, that there is a standard. There is a truth which guides us, to which we must defer. If you want to have it, that the first thing we do is we submit ourselves to the source of all truth, meaning to God, that we must judge our actions by what's right and what's wrong, and that finds its expression in, next line, din. Din in the broad sense, in the sense of only a life which expresses truth, only a life which is based on Torah u'mitzvot, in its broad sense, not just in terms of ritual, but in terms of civil law, in terms of the Jewish sense of justice, in terms of the Jewish sense of mutual responsibility, because we don't have charity. Interestingly, there's no such thing as charity in Judaism. It's tzedakah. Tzedakah means that the Torah has a right to make a demand on your money, and your efforts, and your person to help somebody else. That's what's been going on, in the wake of the tragedy. The Torah makes a demand on you, and we say, fine, that's our privilege. In other words, the din is an expression of how you apply and how you implement the values that are rooted in the roots truths of the Torah. And those together, I think. Accepting Ol Machut Shemayim, accepting the fact that we are grateful to God and we are subordinate to God and we are bound by God and we are bound by truth to try to live in accordance with the absolute standards that we have that in the world, and din, and that the way that we live, that the way that we implement, the way we express, the way we understand and deepen, the way that we interact both with each other is determined by din, by the Torah and the Torah's dictates. And it's, again, in its broad sense, one of the great, I'm emphasizing this because too many people think that to be an Orthodox Jew or to be a loyal Jew, a traditional Jew, it's enough to be to keep Shabbos and to eat kosher. And all that's true. But it also means giving tzedakah. It also means helping when a person is in travail. It also means accepting restrictions on our personal lives. The Torah determines all the things that the Western world says are absolutely our truth. Nobody has a right to tell us otherwise. The Torah says no. The Torah will determine who you can marry and who you can't marry, who you can have relations with and who you can't really have relations with, and when. That's part of truth. It's a global. It's a global, all-encompassing, sacred canopy, to use the famous term that was coined by Peter Berger. And finally, that all of those together lead to a world of evolution, properly done, because you can also be what's called naval birshut haTorah. You can exploit the Torah improperly if you just technically follow things, but you don't take Torah's values into consideration, how you apply the Torah, you can also get to all kinds of not happy and not constructive, even destructive things, that will lead to peace. That leads to a peaceful society upon which it's a pleasure to live. So that's how I would, that's how these words resonate with me on this sad Monday afternoon. Emet, v'shavim mishpat shalom shiftu b'shareichem, in all of our gates, we should know about truth and justice and peace, and something to think about also as we get closer to Shavuot and we work through and re-experience the giving the Torah on Shavuot in a couple of weeks. And with that, we will end today's talk, and we will continue Mitzvah Shem next week. Everybody be well. Bye.